things that don't exist anymore. They used to exist, but not anymore. Now you know what this podcast is for. It's countries that don't exist anymore.
Hello, welcome to this episode of Countries That Don't Exist Anymore. This is a follow-up to the big two-parter we did on the Mughal Empire. So if you haven't listened to that, go back and listen to that. It's great and it's long and it's all empire-y. Joining me right now is my brother Ed, as ever. Hello, Ed.
Hello, Phil. Yep, you're right. I'd say definitely empire-y. Quite a lot Mughal-y. And let's not forget Indian too. And we have an expert in all those things joining us today. Our guest today is an engineer by training, but has since been published as a historian with his recent book, Lords of the Deccan, a narrative history focusing on the medieval history of the Deccan. He's known for two podcasts, Echoes of India and the Indian Military History podcast. And when he's not doing everything else, which he seems to do a lot of, he's also been featured in publications as wide as The Week, India Today, and History Hit. Please welcome to Countries That Don't Exist Anymore, Deccan Special, it's Anirudh Kanasetty.
Hello, hello. Thank you.
Phil, it's up to you to make that sound much more impressive. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'll add a stadium.
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
Yes, for us this is quite early. So usually by now when we're talking to guests, I'll usually be swilling some sort of glass of wine or whatever. But I've got some coffee right now. I'm a bit bleary, but magically 20 minutes later, you'll suddenly find me coming out of all kinds of questions and stuff. That's the power of caffeine. So thank you. You're joining us all the way from India today, aren't you? Where exactly are you based right now?
I'm actually joining you from the Eastern Deccan, from the city of Hyderabad, which has been a major urban center for at least the last 400 years. And since you guys have been talking about the Mughals, Hyderabad is one of the places where the Mughals reached their apogee and also arguably their end.
You know, even if you're not usually based there, the fact that you would move, you know, to put yourself into the Deccan just for today, that's really appreciated. And if you haven't done that specifically, we'll just say you have. So you're like our roving reporter. Yeah. I mentioned in the introduction that you're a podcaster, the Echoes of India and Indian Military History podcast. But, you know, as you say, you've had this massive sprawling narrative history released. I think you called it, I read somewhere, it was sort of a Netflix on paper.
Yes.
which is quite fitting, I think, because I think it was, we talked about the illuminated manuscripts of the Mughals, which often were like sort of the Netflix on illuminated manuscripts. But why are you really fascinated with history in particular, especially because I think you know you started off as an engineer?
My interest in history really started with gaming. A lot of the games that I used to play, especially Age of Empires or Crusader Kings, tended to be very Europe-centric. And I was very curious as to like what kind of role India really played in a lot of what I was doing in these games, right? Which is really how the interest started. I used to read a lot even as a child, but it was only when I was in college that I found myself sufficiently jobless to actually read about things I really enjoyed, which is how I started reading more and more Indian history and kind of realized that, generally speaking, when it comes to understanding of global history or human history at large, Europe tends to play a pretty outsized role. And when it comes to India, you know, when we do hear about India, it's mostly Northern India that we know about. Most people have heard of the Mughal Empire at this point. A good few have also heard of the Mauryas in relation to the conquest of Alexander. But beyond that, in terms of how India is as a subcontinent, and I would actually say that perhaps a better term to actually drive home the size of India is to think of it as a continent rather than a subcontinent. The South Indian state of Kerala, for example, which is one of the smaller Indian states, has a coastline roughly the same length as Portugal, just to give you a sense of how big India is. And the region that I'm particularly interested in, the Deccan region, is about the size of Germany. Now imagine writing a history of Europe without talking about the history of Germany. It'd be absurd. You would not understand why Europe turned the way it did. And yet, when it comes to the way that the world thinks about India, these kinds of omissions are pretty much par for the course. You know, we assume that as long as you know about the Mughals or, you know, a few other empires in northern India, then you know how India generally is, which is really not the case at all. And for me, especially, a big part of my interest in history is driven by this need to understand and tell South India's histories to the world. And there's many, many regions within the subcontinent like that, which are profoundly influential in global history to those who understand and study the regions, but are still kind of like neglected and more or less unknown to the world at large. This gap is really what I try to address through my work, through my podcast, and of course, most recently, through my book.
Yeah, absolutely. And you said something earlier on, which I really had to, because you mentioned obviously Age of Empires as your early interest, and but also Crusader Kings, because it's weird, because I think those are really legitimately great sources to be exposed to things you would never have been exposed to. I think an early episode of our podcast was on the Sultanate of Rum. That was literally a state which, I think, if you play Crusader Kings, the Byzantine Empire would sort of disappear, and then you'd see this state called Rum just come into it. And I remember just scratching my head at the time going, what is this? You know, that then got me actually reading about that and, you know, finding about that as the sort of precursor state to the Ottoman Empire. So I think that's a really interesting way you got into it. And also it's interesting you're focusing on the Deccan, because, you know, I think you described it as a forgotten history of India. You know, our podcast is all about those sort of obscure and forgotten experiments, and I think that's maybe why we generally tend to be a bit more Western focused, because, you know, the nation state as we understand it, you obviously have people setting up little republics based on nothing, but it's kind of a normal way for these things to happen in the Western world. I think, you know, it's funny for an obscure history podcast to really look at the Mughal Empire, which is probably one of the most famous of the Indian states. I realized, I'd said, oh, you know, they had trouble in the Deccan. And really, that's like, there's very little else I could say about it, you know, because obviously we're a time tight podcast. But definitely, I thought, the Deccan, I've just said this thing, it's the size of Germany, and I feel like that's kind of grossly overlooked. You've said, you know, you want to, I think, shed some light onto, like, you know, the Deccan is what you've chosen. What do you think it is about the Deccan that makes it different and distinct from other parts of India?
That's an interesting question, and I think, as with a lot of things in history, the answer is, to begin with at least, geography. The Deccan is an ancient plateau that is about 65, 66 million years ago, that was formed when India was still moving towards this collision with Asia. It's very often thought of as this kind of dry upland region, but it also has the subcontinent's third largest river valley, which is the river valley of the Godavari River. If you kind of look at India's history from like a really bird's eye view, you know, from a long-term macro-historical perspective, what you'll see is that there's this very strange rhythm that seems to happen between northern India and the Deccan, where you will initially see a vast empire emerging in northern India, going out and like wreaking havoc in the rest of the subcontinent, and then it always inevitably seems to run into trouble in the Deccan. And then sooner or later, the Deccan forms its own kind of imperial polity and then kind of like turns the tables on northern India. And I just find that kind of underdog story so fascinating, because the earliest major Indian empires are in northern India. But then in the period where my book is set, from 600 to 1100, the Deccan gradually begins to emerge as India's dominant power. You see various Deccan rulers actually raiding into the Gangetic Plains, and you see the Deccan urbanizing at a pretty unprecedented rate, embarking on the construction of monuments, especially temples, which is of course tied to creating the religious landscape of India as you know it today. For us, it is very difficult to imagine an India that does not have temples in the 21st century, but in the 6th century, that was basically what India was. Temples were really not much of a thing. And if not for the fact that Deccan emperors were so interested in building temples for various reasons, temple-based Hinduism would not have emerged as such a powerful religious force. And the same applies to many ways of thinking about polities in India as well. One thing that characterizes the period from 600 to 1100 is these very kind of networked polities, what scholars call imperial formations. They're somewhat similar to the feudal polities of medieval Europe, but instead of, you know, kings and dukes, you have, for example, kings and kings of kings. So you have these networks of polities that emerge, usually loosely controlled through violent military conquest by an imperial center. And that very much becomes the norm of how Indian polities are organized till at least 1200, when you begin to see a shift towards more kind of centralized bureaucratic states emerging. And if you were to look at the collapse of the Mughals and the aftermath of that as well, you see once again that the Deccan becomes a great powerhouse of its own right. For much of the 1700s, India is basically quaking and is at the mercy of the Marathas, who develop a great deal of their military strategies and technologies from what they learn fighting as the Mughals. And similarly, even beyond that, when you look into the post-1750 period, when you have the British aggressively trying to take over the subcontinent, you see the Deccan again is a region where they tend to have a great deal of trouble. It is extremely difficult for them to bring down the state of Mysore, for example, because Mysore is leading the world in terms of its development of military rocketry and that kind of thing. So you really cannot understand Indian history without understanding the Deccan. You cannot understand India's politics, India's religion, or India's military without understanding the way that the Deccan contributes to all of this. In fact, as much as we think about the Mughals as a gunpowder empire, not a lot of people know that the Deccan was actually far more sophisticated in use of gunpowder much before the Mughals was, before the Mughals were. As early as the 1400s, we have examples of Deccan rulers actually bringing in Persian experts to improve their artillery, their fortifications. And in the early 1500s, we have evidence of even the Portuguese being impressed with Deccan gunpowder weaponry and comparing them to what was being produced in Germany and Bohemia at the time. This is not some kind of backwater. This is very much one of the great arenas of global history. And if we are to understand the way that world history works, we must understand the Deccan.
Yeah, absolutely. And you were taking some of their, you know, military achievements and technology, because obviously that's part of what you're really interested in, military history. You also mentioned the Marathas, and I think what was interesting for us was, I think, was the Jacobeans describing them as you know, naked rogues on horses, or, you know, sort of very much putting them down. But obviously the Marathas seem to have quite the way with cavalry, and you're also saying rocketry and artillery. It's kind of amazing for us, and maybe as a sort of military history expert as well, you could lend some light. I think it was amazing for us to find those times when you had those giant Mughal armies facing off, you know, be it against the Marathas or the East India Company, you know, against armies very, very much smaller than them. But then after the killing of maybe a couple of a hundred, those armies routing and then fleeing. I think it seemed kind of amazing for us because it just seemed, oh no, you know, come back, you've got loads and loads more troops. During this period, how did that work? I mean, how were so much smaller forces able to take on much larger forces in that way?
Well, I mean, there's examples from European history that tell us why. We have many examples of, much before the invention of gunpowder even, of smaller, disciplined, better equipped and better led armies destroying much larger decentralized forces on the battlefield. Whether you're looking at the campaigns of Alexander or of Julius Caesar, or even of Gustavus Adolphus in the 30 Years' War, it is a recurring theme throughout human history that better led armies that are better provisioned, that have better morale, better leadership, just generally tend to outperform much larger armies. And while the Mughal military machine in the early 1600s is absolutely formidable in terms of how it's able to grab hold of the manpower of the Gangetic Plains, train them, equip them, put them on the battlefield, identify the right kind of talent from the lower ranks and promote them higher and higher, that's not necessarily the case for the Mughal Empire as you look towards the late 17th century. the Mughal state gradually becomes far too unwieldy and is not very often led by the most remarkable leaders. It is difficult to see, for example, the kind of absolute brilliance and obsessive micromanagement that you see in Akbar in the late 16th century, in the success of Aurangzeb, for example, right? So when the Mughals arrive in the Deccan, they are not necessarily led by the emperors, but rather by the emperors, sometimes rather dissolute sons and heirs, who are not exactly military men. And while they're often working in partnership with military men, such as Rajput princes are not necessarily as well equipped to command extremely diverse armies. They don't necessarily have a single centralized command structure, a single centralized logistics apparatus through every single campaign that they're fighting in the Deccan. Even so, the Mughals still manage to shine when doing stuff like, for example, besieging cities. They quite easily take the city of Ahmednagar, of Bijapur, and only face real difficulties in terms of siege warfare when they're trying to take the great citadel of Golconda, which is in modern-day Hyderabad. Up till that point, the Mughal Empire seems pretty much unstoppable. It's willing and able to kind of soak up those losses. So the solution that Deccan polities find to fight back against the Mughals is just to make their lives as difficult as possible. The reasons for that are complex. It's not simply a matter of patriotism. It is also a matter of the Mughals just not being politically equipped to incorporate the Deccan sultans into their polity. If you look at the way that the Mughals kind of incorporated the Rajputs, for example, of Western India, you'll see there's a very deliberate policy to make them partners in the Mughal imperial enterprise. And as I mentioned a little earlier, there are Rajput generals and kings participating on the Mughal side when they're conquering the Deccan. So there's a very clear benefit to the Rajputs from participating in the Mughal project of expansion. But that isn't necessarily there for Deccan aristocrats who are now being confronted with the Mughals. They don't necessarily see a reason for them to become subordinates to the Mughals when they are not going to benefit as much from it. Even so, there are some very tantalizing moves that the Mughals make towards trying to incorporate them. If I recall correctly, the Maratha leader Shivaji, who eventually rebels against and founds his own alternative to the Mughal Empire in the Deccan, was originally supposed to accept a position in the Mughal court until their negotiations broke down because Rajput lobbies in the Mughal court would not agree to having this relative outsider having a high status in the Mughal court. If that had worked out the way that Shivaji wanted, he might very well have been one of the Mughal Empire's most loyal supporters if things had gone just a little differently.
That's often the way it works, though, isn't it? It's often backroom dealings, you know, in hindsight, we're like, oh, they were fighting for, you know, their country or something. It's like, no, it's just they didn't get the parking space they wanted. You know, sometimes it can be just backroom dealings and stuff. It's interesting.
So the Mughal failure in the Deccan is not simply a matter of military technology. It's also a matter of logistical failings, of political failings. When they fail to incorporate the Sultanate of Ahmednagar into their polity, you begin to see these displaced Ahmednagari military elites, who very often are Abyssinian or Ethiopian slaves, who have risen up through the ranks militarily. You see them deciding that, you know, they're going to fight and they're going to try and rule their own kingdom. A great example of this is the slave general Malik Amber, who is an Ethiopian by descent, but like lives most of his life in India. And he was actually kidnapped as a young man, sold to a slave market in Baghdad, taught Persian and the Quran and so on before coming to India. And then kind of rises up from like a, you know, a minor cavalry commander to gradually becoming the commander-in-chief of all the forces of the Sultanate of Ahmednagar, partially due to the anarchy that's caused by the Mughal invasion. And what Malik Amber does in the next few decades is that he basically creates his own alternative power structure that kind of leans on these puppet sultans for legitimacy, but in practice is more or less his own domain. He is going to villages and convincing people to become informers for him about Mughal supply lines, for example. He's going out there and building his own forts. He's going out there building his own cities with, you know, advanced irrigation systems and aqueducts and so on. And Malik Amber's main strategy is to never meet the Mughals in battle. He tries on occasion to ally with other sultanates against the Mughals. None of which work out, because every other Deccan Sultanate is suspicious of him. And the strategy that he hits upon is actually to find these young peasant boys that he can put on a horse and train to attack Mughal supply lines. And these young peasants are basically the genesis of the Marathas. In fact, Shivaji's grandfather and father actually earned their spurs, their village chieftains who earned their spurs by working for Malik Amber. The superiority and the ability of Malik Amber to resist the Mughals for so long is because of his ability to command cavalry, and very effective cavalry at that. That's deeply connected to local networks of informants, local centers of power, and that is much more successful in building a political alternative to the Mughals than what the Mughals were able to offer.
That's incredible. So there's like this. There's an Ethiopian ex-slave who is in the Deccan, creating an elite cavalry unit. That's wonderful. We did an early episode on the Empire of Aksum. So it seems it's weird, isn't it? It's like we're all connected somehow. But it's, those kind of stories are absolutely fascinating. They really are. These characters who turn up and then have such an effect on everything around them. That's one sort of good example of how many stories there are to be found. You know, we are newcomers, I think, to Indian history, and this is something we'd like to delve further into. All great empires obviously produce art and architecture, but it seemed to me, you know, you were mentioning temple building and it does seem quite distinctly Indian. Some of the art and architecture seems to go hand in hand with power. Do you think this is distinctly Indian, or is in the Indian experience there's a certain kind of way that that rulers use art and architecture?
I think the urge for elites to make art and to state their power through architecture is pretty much a unified human experience. You see it from the earliest ziggurats to, you know, the Colosseum or the Pantheon, and all the way down to the temples of India or Mesoamerica. It's a consistent thing. Power expresses itself through large, imposing built forms. And that's certainly very important in the Deccan as well. To me, the neglect of the Deccan in understanding Indian art and architecture is again surprising, because having researched it myself, I see its connections to Indian art in general, and also to global art. You will see, for example, in the tombs of the sultans of Golconda and Hyderabad, that they have dragons that are kind of molded plaster and positioned on their tombs, as well as motifs like pineapples. And that might seem a little absurd, but the reason why they had pineapples on their tombs is because pineapples were a sign of globalization. Pineapples are native to Brazil, and they only arrived in India in the 1500s with the Portuguese. To be able to eat a pineapple was a sign of how incredibly, fabulously wealthy you were. Since it's a fruit that's coming from literally continents away, it has all these associations of wealth and good health and so on. And so it's not surprising to see it on a tomb. It's not a sign of Indians being silly, but rather of them trying to depict themselves as being globalized. Interestingly enough, at the same time, Britain also had a craze for pineapples. We know of cases where people were renting out pineapples to have on their tables because it's a sign of how wealthy and globalized they are. So what you're seeing is very much the same symbolic importance that is emerging in two very, very different contexts. Once again, suggesting, like I said, this kind of unity of human experience and the way that power expresses itself. And of course, I could like go on and on about Deccan architecture, but it's difficult to express over audio as opposed to like a video or a diagram. Yeah, so I'm just going to.
I think your point is well made.
I suppose like if the tombstones of today, you know, would have. I'm trying to think of the equivalent. Maybe it's like smashed avocado on sourdough or something like that.
No, I think Britain had the very similar experience with the with the banana in the 1950s. They're like, what is this? The rest of the world were very used to bananas, but we took us a while. We thought this strange yellow snake that you unpeeled. No, I think your point is definitely well made, and obviously it's too often we see, you know, places, especially places we're not familiar in, as in somehow insular, when really the opposite is true. I mean, sort of elsewhere you've talked about this, but it's not like India was ever locked away. It's been exposed to foreign influences back and forth for, you know, forever, really. I think you mentioned from Alexander the Great to the Huns. I mean, it's incredible who has been exposed to India and for how long. What effect do you think outside's early invaders had on India, and perhaps what effect did India have on those outside invaders as well? Is there any particular examples you can think of which are interesting? Sometimes I think of Alexander the Great dressing up to maybe, you know, suddenly coming back looking very Eastern influenced, but are there any stories that you can think of?
It's difficult to come up with a single example. India's influence on global tastes, global aesthetics, global religions is difficult to understate, frankly. And I would say that it actually goes far beyond Alexander. In fact, I think that the way that we think about India's interactions with the world as being driven mostly by quote-unquote foreign invasions is actually far too simplistic. And in my view, at least, kind of like builds on an older colonial way of thinking about Indians as basically these passive, decadent Asiatics who have to come and have civilization imposed upon them, which is not the case at all. In fact, if you look at the art of the Indus Valley civilization from 2500 BC, so we're talking about something that's contemporary to Egypt and Mesopotamia, well before Greece is even urbanizing, well before Rome is anything more than just a collection of hills, you have evidence of pottery from the Indus Valley being exported commercially to Yemen and Oman. And they're doing this taking into account the way that Yemenis and Omanis cook their food, which is to immerse it under sand. So you're literally talking about a globalized economic product that is being produced by sophisticated manufacturing techniques nearly 4,500 years ago. And that influence continues through millennia upon millennia. If you look at Rome's obsession with Oriental magic and the use of spice, especially in Roman magical rituals, that comes because they think of India as this land of wonder and fabulousness. One of the objects that was discovered in Pompeii during excavations in the 1900s is a beautiful little ivory that was probably produced in northwestern India and then exported to Rome via Gujarat and then Alexandria. Even beyond that, we have evidence of elephants being sent by the Abbasids, for example, in an embassy to the Holy Roman Emperor Charlemagne. Where do you think the elephant came from? It obviously came from India. And that's only if you look towards the West, right? And like if we were to move beyond this kind of West-centric understanding of global history towards the East, you will see that most of Southeast Asia adopts to extremely profound level Indian religions and Indian ways of political organization. If you were to look at the design of Angkor Wat, the largest Hindu temple in history, you will see that its fundamental architecture is based on these Indian ideas of mandalas. If you were to look at the presence of Vajrayana Buddhism in Tibet and how that goes on to influence Mongolia and thence into China, if you were to look at scripts like Siddham, for example, which is an Indian-inspired script that is still used in Japanese cemeteries today, if you were to look at the mantras that are chanted in Southeast Asian Buddhism or even in Sri Lankan Buddhism or even in New Age yoga centers in the US today, you will see that India has never been separate or insular from the world. India is central to global history. You cannot understand the world without understanding the history of one-sixth of humanity, and one-sixth of humanity is what India is.
Yes, no, indeed. I think certainly, as you were saying, the spread of trade and culture are almost, you know, permanent throughout history. They bleed their way. I suppose the only reason I was bringing up an invading army, like, for example, I think it was the sort of the Huns, is less about, oh, you know, they're here to, you know, spread this or that. It's more just in such an early age, you're like, what the hell are you doing there? You know, because it, you know, you're talking about such vast distances, can take years for armies to travel that far. So it just seems incongruous. Whereas I think when you're, as you rightfully say, when you see the spread of culture and you see the, you know, the spread of goods, you can, it's still incredible, but you kind of get a sense of, oh, I can, it, that's not the work of one lifetime, like that's the work of a long historical process. But your point is certainly well taken. Now, in our podcast, as I say, we often we are kind of focusing on these, you know, sometimes nation states, these accidents of history, and there's obviously a lot more of that goes on in the Western world. But when we do start to look at other areas of the world, as we should, you know, I get into this thing of telling the story of a place, and then suddenly Western imperial people turn up and, you know, spoil everything, or then it becomes a story about them. And that's not something we'd like to do. We'd probably like to sort of get further and deeper back. So actually, I think the question I'd like to ask you is, if we're going to look at maybe sort of Indian states, maybe earlier, do you have any examples that it might be good for us to look at? I read somewhere you were talking about ancient Indian republics, the Ganarajas, I think. Do you think that kind of thing would be quite interesting to look at? I mean, it's just a opinion, I guess, but what would you recommend us looking into?
I would say that India is just full of very, very interesting countries for you all to talk about. The Ganarajas are certainly fascinating. I would just say that have your bullshit detectors out and ready when you're reading the scholarship about them, because a lot of the scholarship is trying rather anachronistically to prove that India invented democracy before, you know, Athens, which seems like a silly comparison to me. The Ganarajya structure is totally different from the way that Athenian democracy worked. And it's worth studying as a distinct political form in its own right. That's not exactly a democracy, not exactly a monarchy. And that for many centuries was the way that Indian polities in the Gangetic Plains worked. And it was really only the result of rather some quirks of history that Ganarajyas came to be wiped out and replaced by these great Gangetic empires that we are now used to. If some things had worked out a little differently, then you could very well have seen North India continuing with like smaller republics until things, you know, things went south somehow or the other way. And even more recently, there's many, many interesting examples that you might want to look at. I would suggest that you actually look at the state of Hyderabad itself, which was ruled by a Mughal successor state until the mid-1900s, when it was challenged in the 1920s and 30s by a massive communist peasant rebellion that was so pervasive that for decades after Hyderabad was incorporated into the Union of India, it was said that you could literally have a lamppost run on a communist ticket and it would still be guaranteed to win an election. And it's an uprising.
It was a bit of Rosette on a pig.
Something like that. And there's so many examples like this. And even if you want to have, you know, these grand tragic empires, you can look at, for example, the Chola Empire of the medieval period, which pretty unprecedentedly for any Indian polity goes and raids Southeast Asia on multiple occasions. You can look at the Rashtrakuta and Chalukya empires, which I talk about in a great deal of detail in my book, where I explain why and how the Deccan came to be a major geopolitical arena and how it interacted with not just India at large, but the world at large, because you have examples of Arab travelers writing about how the ruler of the Deccan is on par with the Abbasid Caliph and the Emperor of Rome and the Emperor of China. These are stories that need to be heard and need to be told to the rest of the world.
That sounds like an excellent starting point, and maybe an even better starting point is to read your book, Lords of the Deccan. That might, and I would suggest everyone who's listening to that, maybe that's a great starting point to uncover some of those stories from Indian history that really need to be told. So you must be pretty exhausted. You've just completed this, you know, huge work, and now you're promoting it. What do you have coming up? Is there anything are you taking a break at the moment, or have you thought, right, I've got my next narrative history lined up, or are you working on other projects? What's going on in your life?
A whole bunch of things. I'm actually working on a couple of museum podcasts, among the first Indian museum podcasts to ever be made. One of them is actually about India's Christian art. The region of Goa, which was ruled by the Portuguese, produced large quantities of Christian art, ivories that were exported to Lisbon and Europe, for example. And a lot of them have a lot of interesting Indian characteristics, like you will see, for example, Christian saints wearing saris. And these again are like stories that deserve to be told. In addition to that, so I work at the Museum of Art and Photography, which is based in Bangalore. And we've just created India's first ever totally online, totally free encyclopedia of art with over 2,000 entries covering 10,000 years of Indian art history and more to come, including an art history podcast which I'm working on. And yes, of course, I do a column for a publication called The Print. It's called Thinking Medieval. I basically explore medieval India's connections with the world, both East and West. And finally, yes, I am working on my next book. It is once again a narrative about medieval South India, but with a much more global focus. I am looking at the East Coast of India and how it interacted with Southeast Asia at large, and talking about how the medieval Indian Ocean world was strikingly similar to the globalized world that we are familiar with today. And the intention very much is to put the scholarship and the understanding of medieval South India's role in the global economy on par with the understanding of the Mongols, right? While the Mongols were initially thought of as nothing more than barbaric despoilers, a lot of popular history writing has shown that they played a tremendous role in kind of changing how trade worked in Eurasia and thus accelerating the pace of globalization. And the same argument can very well be made for various polities in southern India. And once again, these are stories that the world needs to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like the way you're doing this, definitely creating, I think it's fair to say, it's serious history, but at the same time, quite accessible and approachable stuff, and you know, which helps popularize it. I don't. There a few years ago, there was the book, The Silk Road, and that was quite a nice example of, you know, just introducing, just by using what one MacGuffin, not really a MacGuffin, it's very important, but just to open up so many stories and to really connect the world in the way that world history should be understood, which is one interconnected. That sounds fantastic. We will definitely be dipping into those. Thank you for coming on today. So I think on many topics I can probably talk with some vague bluffing, but I think it's fair to say on Indian history I have to put my hands up and just say, you know, this is, we're new into it, we are absolutely fascinated by what we found out so far, so we'll be delving further into it. But thank you for coming on and being our patience experts and teacher into the Indian world. It's been fascinating.
My pleasure. I'm really glad that you guys are going to be doing more India, and I can't wait to hear what else you guys come up with.
Superb. Anirudh, thank you very much. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Countries don't
exist anymore. Hello, listeners. That was fascinating for me, for sure. I hope it was for you too. Go and check out all Anirudh's stuff. I'm very interested to go and find out that massive collection of art that's online and free. So go and check it out. Ed, I hope we'll put some links in the show notes to all that. So that's great. Ed, will you go and put some links in the show notes?
Yes.
Thanks, Ed. So Anirudh gave us some recommendations there. If you've got your own recommendations or request, do get in touch with us, ctdeapod@gmail.com. Go to the website. There's lots of fascinating articles there connected with all the shows that you're hearing. And Ed's a very good article writer, and I can thoroughly recommend it. So go there. It's part of his job. So next time in Countries That Don't Exist Anymore, we'll be coming to something that's really quite relevant today as we're looking at the Carpathian Ukraine. If you want to find out what all that's about, then make sure you join us next time on... Countries That Don't Exist Anymore. They used to exist, but not anymore. Now you know what this podcast is for. It's Countries That Don't Exist Anymore.